And we are back for the Parish of the Patriots. The wait is over. It's Tuesday. There's one thing to look forward to, Tuesday. That's why Tuesday should be your favorite day. If I do say so myself, Tuesday be your favorite day because you get to listen to this show. Of course, then again, you may just wait and listen to it at a different time. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when you listen. Just as long as you listen. 229th, is that right? Oh, time is just flying by. 229th installment of the show. As always, we do remind you, don't forget Sven. We've got our support links down there for Sir Longshanks. We're not going to forget Sven and look forward to his timely release. Look forward to him getting out. Look forward to the quality here at Radio Albion returning to what we've all come to expect. And speaking of supportive, if you do get something out of this, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. If you get something out of the show, I mean, you get the show for free, obviously. There's nothing behind any paywalls or anything like that. But if you do get something out of it, it's a blessing for me if you put something in the plate. Because I'm poor. And I appreciate it. Really, really do. And that's easy. Just look here on our description page. Look right there. I've got snail mail says you can tithes can be sent to. And there's a snail mail address. Got a Bitcoin address. Got a Monero address there. Got email. You can drop your notes there. If you've got a different cryptocurrency, trust me, I can get you an address for that. And I'm not proud. I will take your alt coins. Let's get into the listener supporter mailbag for this week. Mr. T, and yes, I did get two notes from Mr. T, the post office, with all of its expected level of efficiency. I did get two notes from Mr. T, so I did get two and I do appreciate it. GPD, I've heard experts say that in the event of a nuclear exchange, that for the most part, the cities on the east and west coast will be targeted, as well as the silo farms in Montana. Is this a bad thing, Mr. T? Well, yes, because the people in Montana don't... People, what did Montana ever do? Montana didn't ask for missile silos in Montana. Yeah. And before I forget, as to the other thing, as to you take your blessings where you get them, you know, it might really, it is. I understand what you're saying, but it is a blessing. You know what I'm talking about. I just leave it at that. In other words, it could always be worse. It amazes me that. As things continue to escalate, and we're just regular people here, we sit here and look at the belligerent foreign policy of the U.S. And things are observably, and by every metric, escalating. And the people who are nominally in charge, or at least the front people that are out there, are very much observably not very smart. Doesn't look like it then. Well, I don't know. They just always think that, you know, nothing could actually happen. Grandpa Dan, hope this finds you well. I will figure out how to send Sven money. Thank you for your help with getting us the information. I pray for you, and may God bless you, Debbie. And thank you very much. And God has blessed me a lot. And you are part of that with your support. It really is. I do view it that way. And very, very much appreciate it. As far as, I mean, just my personal opinion, the easiest way, if you want, I mean, there is this email a prisoner program. You can sign up for that. You got to give your real information. I don't know if y'all want to do that. But you actually just send emails and forego letters. If not, I mean, just do the letter thing. Just write snail mail. It's fine. He enjoys that. As I said before, he can only, he can only himself mail out two letters a week. So, you know, don't get offended if he doesn't write you back. Don't be like imagine he threw it away in the trash. It's just he can only write two a week. But as far as financial support, and this is my opinion, y'all do what you want to do, what you feel the most comfortable with. But the give, send, go thing is going to be the easy. I mean, really, that is the easiest way. I don't know how long I've heard people say there ought to be a way I could send support with a credit card or a debit card. Well, now there is. That's the easiest. I mean, yeah, it's calculated in British pound sterling. So if you send, 20 pounds, if you put down 20 pounds, you can still pay it with your credit or debit card. Now, it's going to wind up costing you like $27 because of the exchange rate and whatnot. But that's the easiest way. To me, that's the easiest way. But you, like I say, there's any number of ways. I would just, whether you send financial support or not, and I hope you can, I do encourage y'all to write letters, even snail mail, because the letters mean a lot. And he has said this, and he gets all these letters, and it's very moving. So one way or the other, I hope y'all can continue to do that. Finally, wrapping up here, let's see, GPD. I do hope you and Matt Johnson and the others behind the scenes can continue your content on RA and not let it fade away. Your voices are sorely needed in these times. May our God protect Sven and ensure his prompt and safe returns. Regards, Eric. And I would say amen to that. And no, you don't have anything to worry about, because as far as me and Dr. Johnson, there are no... The others behind the scene are those of you who listen. There are no others behind. We do not have a vast technical support staff. If so, things would be better, better quality. It's just us. So, we have every intention to continue to do this. So, don't worry. And again, I really do. I make light of it, but I really do appreciate y'all, because I understand. I mean, there was so much more content when Sven was able to manage this. It was his baby. I told Sven, I remember telling him on several occasions and before he was sentenced, I told him, I said, you are Radio Albion. And I continue to believe that. I mean, this is what he made. And we're just house sitting here and trying to hold it together for him to get back. And we're all looking forward to that. I guess what I'm getting to is I realize the amount of content and I joke about the quality, but Dr. Johnson and I, we're putting our best effort forward. There's just a lot of little details I know were being done and I can tell. Some of y'all may not notice, but I can tell that I'm not able to do or whatever. We're just trying to keep the content up. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I really do appreciate y'all sticking with us. And I know things like the stream don't work anymore. I know things like the way the pages, the homepage updates is not necessarily like it was before. And I do. I appreciate y'all sticking with us through this. And at least, we're all going to keep on moving forward till he can get back and set things aright. Well, that gets us all through the listener supporter mailbag. So now we're at the official first part of the show, which is basically me talking about whatever I want to. Obviously, if you're new here, by the way, I always say this at the beginning. I didn't this week. We have a Christian specific segment, roughly the halfway part of the show, but it's really roughly. Sometimes way earlier, sometimes way later. So y'all but stick around for it. I think you won't be disappointed. The first part of the show, I talk about whatever I want to. And before Sven got sent away, I would a lot of times talk about current events, news, what's going on in the news and things such as that. And I'm kind of less inclined to do so here at the Parish of the Patriots, because now I'm doing the Daily Nationalist on Mondays and Fridays. And that's, of course, news story oriented, which has taken a lot of getting used to and going through articles and news stories. So I'm less inclined. And the last thing, honestly, I feel like talking about is current event news stories in the first part of the show. So this frees me up to ramble about other things that I'm interested in that maybe you may or may not be interested in. I was thinking the other day about, I've always been a working person. My whole life. I've been a regular working man. I come at these things. I communicate in the language of the regular way. I spent my whole life being a regular working man. Now I'm kind of just, I just do what I can to make ends meet. And I'm a kind of quasi unemployable, but I do this work and, but I've always been a working man. And I've always felt like in this country, in this society, the working people don't get nearly enough respect. And I've said that on many occasions. And everything is kind of twisted up and turned. And I think as things go downhill at some point in time when societal quote unquote order, when things reset, everybody's going to be shocked. You know, I've said before, you know, if you've got some kind of journalism degree or something, that isn't going to be any good. What's going to matter is what can you do? You know, if somebody, your neighbor's got something that you need them to share with you, what do you have to offer in exchange? And, you know, if all you're bringing to the table as far as ability and know-how is a journalism degree, that isn't going to get you very far. In this society, working people are crapped all over. And those who are held in regard are those, by and large, who don't really actually do anything. We look at somebody, oh, he's a stockbroker. He trades stocks. You know, he gets a commission and he has all of this money. And you may have a bunch of money and you may live in a fine gated community. And the only reason you're not living in absolute utter filth is because that guy out there on the trash truck that you snub your nose up at comes by and picks your garbage up. I never understood the reasoning, you know, belittling people that do the very things that have to be done in order for things to keep moving forward. If nobody comes and picks your garbage up, I don't care what kind of fancy gated community you live in, you are going to be living in filth with roaches and rats and everything else because your garbage is going to pile up. You need that person. And yet as a society, we look down on those people. Now, I say that up front because what I really want to get into, see, that wasn't actually what I really wanted to get into. I wanted to lay that foundation because what I really wanted to get into is talking about the twisted relationship when it comes to workers, employees, and employers in this society. And before I got into that, I wanted to, you know, make clear that, you know, working people are the only reason we have any functionality at all. Somebody's got to fix the pipe. Somebody's got to pick up the garbage. Somebody's got to be able to fix things when they break. Somebody's got to hook your electricity up so that you can be pretentious and drive around in your damn Tesla like you're better than everybody else, and so on and so forth. But we look at the relationship between employers and employees, and you have to understand, it is always going to be, the dynamic is set up and will always be that of a slave and a master. Your employer, is the master and you are the slave. And that is always going to be the dynamic. It's unavoidable. If you go out and take a job working for your best friend says, man, you know, we're tight, we're cool. Let me hire you in my business. I got a business. I need some help. You know, you need a job. I need some help. Let me hire you. And you may be like, yeah, this is great. I love Bob. We cool. We've been friends forever. This is going to be great. And I can guarantee you there's no way you can be Bob's friend and maybe even try to continue that on some level or another. But that role, whatever friendship you have, is going to inevitably take a back seat to the new role. Because as soon as you go to work for Bob, you're no longer a friend. You're an employee. You're a slave. And he's your master. They always go on about slavery in this country. The U.S. is just, well, we're not. The narrative is always this obsession with slavery that happened all these years ago. And the poor black people were enslaved. Part of that is a distraction because they don't want people to realize that you're all slaves. It's not like the slaves back then were not compensated. They weren't necessarily compensated in money, but they were guaranteed shelter, you know, housing, health care, food, clothing. They were guaranteed all of these things. And people said, well, at least we're not slaves today. Yeah, you work from check to check. You have no money in the bank. You're putting in more hours than a slave did back then. I mean, really? No, I mean that. Sure, the slaves had to work hard out in the heat or whatever. But, you know, it's not harvest season. It's not farming season. Farming is seasonal. It's not a year-round thing. So they essentially had months that they were off and they would work on, you know, where we're going to go out and fix this fence today. We're going to do these other things that need to be done. You working check to check and barely making it by. And what you got? maybe, hopefully, shelter over your head, some clothing that's getting wore out, and some junk food maybe that you can buy. In other words, you got the same thing slaves do, except the masters don't actually owe that to you. If they don't pay you enough to where you can't actually afford rent and you're sleeping in your car, that's your problem. In other words, you're cheaper than a slave. It's a slave master. It's a slave master relationship. And there's no way of getting around that. And if you think it's something else or other, you're kidding. You are kidding yourself. I know, been there, done that. At some point in time, you'll find out that no, indeed, that's what it is. We're taught our whole lives from being kids. We are prepared. Part of what school does is to prepare you to accept and embrace that dynamic. Embrace your role as a slave. Embrace your role. What are we taught? You're taught that if you quit your job, you owe it to your employer to give them a 2-week notice. You owe it to them. The least you can do is to give your employer a 2-week notice. You know, he did you the favor of hiring you. And see, I'm telling you that dynamic is all screwed up because they're not hiring you out of charity. They're hiring you because they are profiting. They're profiting from your labor. If you get hired for $10 an hour, the only reason they hired you for $10 an hour is the way it works out, the way the math works out, is they're say, and I'm just throwing numbers around to make the point. Me be like, I make more than $10 an hour. That's irrelevant. If they're paying you $10 an hour, it's because your labor is resulting in them receiving $20 an hour. So after they give you your 10, they're pocketing $10 an hour and they don't have to do anything. Now, you tell me who owes who here. You know, I mean, really, who? But yet you're told you owe them. You owe your massa. You owe your massa at least a 2-week notice if you're going to quit. But why do you owe them? They're pocketing $10 an hour for free. They're not even having to do anything. When it's all said and done, they're clearing $10 an hour. That's the only reason they're hiring you. If they were paying you $10 an hour and your labor was only bringing back in $10 an hour, they're going to cut your ass loose and they ain't going to give you no 2-week notice. Ain't going to give you no severance pay. They're going to bring you in. They're going to say, well, this is your last day. We can't use you anymore. We're cutting you loose. Trust me, I know. And it don't matter if you've worked there 20 years. They're going to cut your ass loose. And then you spend all these years and you're like, oh, yeah, you know, I have this great relationship with my boss and my company and all of that. And you start convincing yourself that you ain't a slave and they ain't your massa. And then the day comes around and they call you in and say, we can't use you anymore. Goodbye. Good luck. Hope you find something else. Hell, at least when a slave got sold back in the day, they got sold to somebody else. They had guaranteed employment. You got sold. You're going to be, now you go to work. You already had a new guaranteed master, you know, guaranteed job. You owe them your gratitude. Thank you, massa. I really have appreciated working for you, massa. I'm not being racist. And I'm not. I'm just, when you talk about slaves, that's the way, you know, people always portray massa. I'm surprised they don't make employees wear a name badge that says Toby on it. That whole dynamic plays out. Y'all know what I'm talking about. You're at work and you look up and oh, next week on Wednesday, I gotta go to my kid. You got to go to your kid's play. They're having a play at school and you really want to go. And the play is at 3:00 in the afternoon, which means you're going to have to take off early. Y'all all have been here and done this. You know what I'm at. This is hitting home. You leading up, you got to go in the boss's. You got to go see your boss. You got to go to your boss. And you're getting that emotional feel. You know, you got that feel because you got to go to your boss. And you're like, massa, next Wednesday, I really needs to get off at 3:00. So you had to ask. You had to beg permission. Your life isn't even yours anymore. You got to beg permission. I really want to go see this my kids play because, I don't know, it's going to be the only time in my life that I get to see my child at this stage of their life do this thing. And I'd really like to like enjoy part of watching them grow up. But you got to go with hat in hand. And as I know we're busy right now, but I really need to be off next Wednesday. I mean, I'll come in and work and maybe pick up an extra shift if you need me to make up for it. You know, I make up for it to you, Master. They're profiting off of you. That's why you have a job. But that's not what we're taught. We're taught that we owe them. We are slaves. Oh, I'm sick. I've got to call in. And what some and they'll tell you, well, you need a doctor's note. You see, that's why. You're taught this. When you're a little kid and you're in school and you miss school, where they say, oh, well, you need a doctor's excuse. Otherwise, it's an unexcused absence. It's going on your record. You call your boss up. It's like, man, I'm sick. I don't know. I've got the Confica virus or something. I'm sick. It's like, well, you bring in a doctor's. See, you've been trained. When your employer says, bring a doctor's excuse, your reaction isn't, are you calling me a liar? Your reaction is, yes, sir, boss, because you were taught that. You were taught that your entire life. When you were a kid in school and you had to bring a doctor's excuse, see, it's nothing new. When your employer says, bring a doctor's excuse, you're going to go shuffle off to the doctor, whether you can afford to pay for the doctor or not, because you see, your employer doesn't have to pay for the doctor. You do. You go, but you show up when you get back. See, I'm feeling a little better now. Here's my excuse. I got an excuse so you know I wasn't lying. Get back to work, Wagey. And they're profiting off of you. They're making money off of you and putting, and they don't even have to do anything. And it gets worse. We know for a fact that wages have been stagnant in this country basically since the 1970s. We got inflation and the wages have adjusted somewhat for inflation, but at the end of the day, cost of living and all that factored in, they're stagnant or even declining. And what do? We got to bring more people in. They got women in the workforce, which kept wage helped. One of the aspects of it is to keep wages down. They want to bring in infinity immigration. And one of the aspects of that, just one of them, I'm not saying it's the only aspect. Don't be hollering at me and go, yeah, but what I'd also, yes, I know this, but I'm just talking, this is our topic. We're staying on topic today. That competition keeps wages down. People are getting, all in all, poor. And everything, when the government talks about we need some, this economic policy, it's always, always, always going to be geared to keep wages down. Young people, like these young leftists and stuff that are that are idiots. I actually wasn't profanity almost slipping out because I was already skipping towards idiots. And I was like, you know, I had the S coming out and it kind of sounded like that. These idiots will listen to some Democrat politician talk about we want to guarantee people a kajillion dollar an hour minimum wage. And they're so young and they're so stupid. They believe that. Let me tell you, both parties are always going to work to keep wages low. That will always be the policy, to keep wages low. It's never, ever, ever going to go the other direction. And if you think it is, you're an idiot. They're always going to keep those wages down, and it gets worse. It's bad enough that people basically can't hardly afford a place to live now. But it gets worse because now they're moving everybody. They're getting everybody prepped and they're moving. And they've been very open discussing about that. They're moving everybody towards this gig economy. That's what they're moving everybody towards. And they're already implementing it. Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber. There's all of these different gig economy deals that you can do. Now, right now, they're kind of marketing it as, well, you can do it like for extra money. You know, this is just a side gig. You're doing this for extra money. And you'll see people. I saw there was a story about a DoorDash driver that was rude to some woman. And why it was a story, I don't know. I don't care. People rude to each other every day. And somebody said, you know, I saw somebody making the comment, well, it's stupid. These gigs, this is supposed to be a side hustle. This isn't supposed to be your main income. And there's somebody who has no idea what's going on. That's what it is right now. But they've been very open about this is what they're moving everything to. This is part of the whole Great Reset thing, is this gig economy. This isn't a conspiracy theory. They're implementing it. They're just having to do it step by step. But they're moving everybody to this gig economy model. And what does that look like? You're going to make less money. You understand, this isn't like you're going to make more money doing these stupid gigs. Because once they transition, the more people that transition. I saw a news story that I didn't even read it. I saw an article the other day. I didn't even read it because I already knew what it was. And it was something like, oh, this DoorDash, I think it was DoorDash, this DoorDash driver on some island or something, I don't know. He's making $114,000 a year. I already knew it was bullshit. You know, maybe he's the only one there, but he's not making that much. And we'll get into why that is here in a minute. But they're trying to get everybody into this idea. You are going to be more poor under the gig economy. Let's just stick with these deliveries. Say DoorDash or Grubhub, whatever. What are you going to pick on DoorDash today? But they're all work under the same model. It's just as we talked about earlier about when you're a wage, when you're an employee, when you're the slave, they're paying you $10 an hour and they're making $10 an hour profit that they put in their pockets that they don't have to do anything. That's the only reason they're hiring you. Not because they're benevolent, not because of charity or they're being generous. And I'm not even saying, you know, like they should be like hiring you out of charity. I'm just saying the dynamic should be one based in truth. Anyway, with the gig economy, they don't even have to do that. They don't even have to employ you. Under the gig economy, say you got DoorDash. And you got these DoorDash people, and they think they're making money, but they're not making money. They're doing all these deliveries. And, you know, I don't know, $7 here, $5 here, $10 there, da-da-da-da-da. And at the end, they get their little kickback from Grubhub or whoever they're working for. And they look at that, and they say, I made $200 this week. You got to subtract now, how much time did you put into that? How much gas? And the big one that creeps up that nobody seems to be able to figure out is how much wear and tear on your vehicle. You're wearing your car out doing this. And it gets worse. See, the only reason they're doing this is now, okay, you're delivering groceries for Walmart. You know why? Because now Walmart can say, we have delivery service, and they don't have to hire a delivery driver. They don't have to buy delivery vehicles. They don't have to keep up, maintain, insure those vehicles. They're not giving you these gigs out of their own charity, because now they don't have to pay for any of that. You do it. You are paying for the upkeep on Walmart's delivery vehicles, and they don't have to do anything. Give you $5, $10, whatever the hell they're paying, whatever pittance. And let me tell you what's going to happen with this. Mark my words. This is what's going to happen with this. Because right now, people are using their personal vehicles. They're running around delivering food, groceries, whatever the hell else. They're using their own personal vehicles. And this all works together. The insurance companies right now are letting that go because they want to get everybody sucked into it first. So the insurance companies are just looking the other way while this is going on, because they got to get everybody into this gig economy. But what is going to happen is at some point in time, somebody will be the first one. They're going to be doing one of these deliveries, and they're going to get in a car wreck. And when the insurance is claimed, somebody at the insurance company is going to say, hey, what were you doing when this wreck happened? And they're going to say, well, I was doing DoorDash. I was delivering. And the insurance company is going to say, oh, wait a minute. You are operating a commercial enterprise with your vehicle. You don't have commercial vehicle insurance. You don't have commercial insurance. We're not paying. We're not paying. You've got to have a commercial policy. You think you work in check to check and not making anything now? They get everybody in this gig economy. You're really going to be a slave. Because they do it for even less. I want to say everybody does, or everybody. People are doing these things thinking they're making extra money. Maybe they're making a little extra money. But they're not. Again, they're doing this not out of charity. Just like your employer, regular employer, isn't hiring you because they like you. is because now they're doing these gig things. They don't have to pay a delivery driver. Like I say, they don't have to keep up a car. They don't have to pay that commercial insurance. That's a heck of a deal for them, isn't it? And what we see here, we need to get into the Christian-specific segment. But you see that the slave-master dynamic has never gone away. Slavery was really never abolished. It was simply repackaged. It was redesigned. It was repackaged in a way where the slaves, they don't even know they're slaves. And your benefits are actually going down. They get you transitioned into this gig economy, and now there's no other way. Right now, they're not, like I said, stuff like the insurance companies looking the other way. That's temporary. And my first reaction when I started hearing about this and reading about it, and I thought, how is it you're delivering, you're using your personal vehicle? Technically, it could be classified as a commercial vehicle. How is it that people are getting away with that? Well, it's because the insurance companies are letting it go for now because they've got to get you sucked into this. Right now, you could quit doing that and go get a regular job. When they get everybody on this gig economy, you won't have that option. And then you're going to make even less money because they're going to say, well, you got to have commercial insurance and it's going to be twice as high as your regular car insurance. Rents for a place to live ain't going to be going down. You're just going to be running all over, working 24 hours a day, wearing yourself and your car out, trying to get your $5, $10, $15 wherever here and there. And at the end of the day, and guess what? Then you got to pay tax on it. You can pay tax on it. The slaves back in the day didn't have to pay tax on being a slave, but you're going to be paying tax on it. The point here is the slave master dynamic has never gone away. They just remarketed it. And all, everybody is still a slave, and they don't even realize it. They're still a slave, and they think they're free. We got to wrap up and get into the Christian specific segment. If you're new, don't skip it. I think you'll get something out of it. But if, you know, whatever, you don't want to, you can't say I didn't warn you. Either way, get in there. Let's get in there. Fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon here at the Parish of the Patriots. So for this week's Christian specific segment, we're going to do things a little bit different. It's not like I'm not trying to change the way we do things necessarily. We'll continue to do things the way we usually do, but this week it's a little different for the simple fact that I want to cover a lot of material. And specifically, we're going to be discussing 2 Kings chapter 5. Yes, that's right, the entirety of the chapter. Now, obviously, I cannot sit here and just read the entire chapter to you because that would take up basically the entirety of our 30 minutes, and y'all would go to sleep listening to me just simply reading, and we wouldn't get the point. But there's, in 2 Kings chapter 5, there's just a whole lot of different things happening that I think really we can look at these things from our own perspective and kind of apply them to the way we ourselves or other people interact when the Lord is doing things in our lives or around us. And I think it can mean something to us. It's an interesting historical account, of obviously, as well. Now, again, since I cannot read the entirety of the chapter, I encourage y'all, if you find this story, these events interesting, by all means, I encourage you to take your time and read the entire chapter. It's not like it's going to, you know, take up your whole day or something. But since I thought we'd all talk about the entire chapter, I've got to do it a certain way. Now, I've got this experience of doing the Daily Nationalist show, so I'm kind of applying that here. And what we're going to do is I'm just going to read sections and that kind of are pertinent to what I thought we would discuss this week and just kind of stop there. So in other words, we're going to do 2 Kings chapter 5, but we're going to be kind of skipping through, just hitting the high points. And again, if you find this interesting, by all means, you know, read the whole thing. So let's just, knowing that, and again, I'm going to do things this way every week. It's just, for whatever reason, this week I decided I wanted to do this entire chapter, and this is the only way I can see realistically doing this. Now, as I have no idea how long, you know, how time consuming this is going to be, let's just go ahead and get right to it. So we're going to start off, obviously, in 2 Kings chapter 5. We're just going to do verses 1 through 3. And this starts introducing us to who some of the people involved, some of the main participants in what is happening here, and kind of lays down the setting. Oh, and also, yes, I'm probably going to screw these names up, so y'all don't And he'd be like, you didn't pronounce that right. Because I know this. Now, Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man, and his master, and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out by companies, and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would deliver him of his leprosy. So you have this guy, and he was a mighty man in Syria. Now, these, of course, obviously back then, these countries were always raiding each other's territories and taking captives away. Basically, we're talking about slaves. They would go in and capture people and bring them back. And that was just kind of a way of life. Now, this guy had leprosy. I always imagine leprosy is pretty much a condition where your skin is rotting off. I've read different accounts of exactly what this disease is, but you can just think of it as having sores or your skin rotting off. It was a bad condition. Now, out of the people that were taken captive, they had this little maid. So it was a young girl here, and they took her in. She captive, and she waited on this guy's wife. Now, what's interesting, first thing that's interesting here is that she obviously is treated very well. I mean, she just, you would think these people came in, you know, grabbed this girl up and made her a slave. You know, she would hate them. You know, she would be bitter towards him. But obviously, this isn't the case. Obviously, she's treated quite well because she says, oh, if only my Lord, she's not talking about the Lord, her Lord. If God was willing, if only my Lord. So in other words, this great man, this mighty man of Syria, if only he could be with the prophet in Samaria, then he would be healed. I found this interesting because she has no bitterness towards him. Obviously, she's wishing things would go well for them. She's treated well, and I'm going to assume from here she's happy. She's not cursing them. Instead, she gives this information out voluntarily. If only. So this girl can see that this is a good man. His family are good people. They're treating her well. She's not, you know, being treated awful. If only he could be with the prophet Samaria, he could be healed of this horrible condition, because she feels like he doesn't deserve this. These people are treating me well. He doesn't deserve this. Now, it's just something hard to imagine, but this is what happened. We think of raiding parties coming in. If somebody came in, if you imagine, put yourself in those times, and a raiding party came in and you were taken captive, and you say, okay, now you're going to go wait on this family. You're going to be a servant here. It's hard to imagine to be in a situation to where you would be like, okay with that. But these are different times. And we don't know the time frame. We don't know how long after she was taken captive that she became, so, because obviously some time went by here. She got comfortable enough that she felt it was fine to speak, and she came to know who these people were. And I would say they were like family to her. And she gives this information. If only he could go to the prophet in Samaria, he would be healed of his leprosy. Now, she says this, and word gets back. And people say this, and obviously this guy really wants to be healed. And so word gets back, and the king tells this guy, he says, go, you know, he's going to take, obviously he's got to take gifts with him. Go to the king of Israel, and the king of Syria says, I'll write a letter on your behalf and, you know, present that to the king of Israel, and we'll see what happens. He takes a bunch of silver, a bunch of gold, and a bunch of changes of clothes, you know, fine garments with him as gifts to offer to whoever it needs to be offered to see if they can make this happen. Now, we're going to skip forward to verses 6 through 7. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now, when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman, my servant, to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy. And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me. So the letter says, you know, I'm sending this guy so you can cure him of his leprosy. Now, the king of Israel takes this as he's picking a fight. He's sending this guy and asking the impossible. I'm sending this guy to you and I want you to cure him of his leprosy. The king of Israel doesn't understand what's being conveyed. I think the king, you know, and some of this as we go through, is you have to kind of add your own, you know, kind of putting yourself in everybody's shoes and trying to understand this miscommunication, because we know, obviously, that the king of Syria isn't picking a fight here. So you have to assume, because he worded it this way, that he just assumed that the king of Israel know that he was saying, hey, send this guy to the prophet, to the man of God. He assumed that, but this didn't even cross the king of Israel's mind. So the king of Israel says, well, this guy's just picking a fight. He sends somebody important in his kingdom to me and says, hey, heal him of his leprosy. Obviously, that's something you can't do. So he's supposing that the king of Syria, when he obviously can't do that, says, well, I sent this man and asked you to do something, and you refused to do it. So he's completely misread the situation, and it never crosses his mind to send him to the man of God. Now, Elisha hears that the king of Israel has rent his clothes. I have no idea how he has heard of this, if it was just rumor or gossip, or if perhaps the word of the Lord spoke to him and said, this is going on. But either way, he sends word to the king of Israel and says, why have you rent your clothes? Send this man to me, and they'll know there's a prophet in Israel. So they do. This guy goes ahead and heads out. Now we get into some of the key interactions that I find really interesting, because in a lot of ways, I think it's typical of how all of us would react if we were in that kind of situation. So let's go ahead and pick up at verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariots and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come clean to thee, and thou shalt be clean. But Naaman was wroth, and went away, and said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me, and stand, and call on the name of the Lord his God, and strike his hand over the place, and recover the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? And he turned and went away in a rage. Now, Elisha doesn't even come out to see him. Elisha just has somebody else come out on his behalf and tell him, go do this. Go to the River Jordan and wash in it 7 times. Now, I think one of the important takeaways from what we've read here is the way in which Naaman has reacted and why he reacts that way. He reacts this way because he has it set in his mind what is going to happen. He has this, and this is why we really got to be careful, especially when it comes to, you know, if we're praying or we think God, or we're praying for God to bring something about in our lives, or to deliver us in a way, or to do something in our lives, having this preconceived notion of what God's going to do. And then when it doesn't happen that way, we completely miss the point, which is what Naaman did. He had it set in his mind he was going to show up, because he says so, right? Very clearly. You know, he thought he was going to show up. He's got all his chariot. He's bringing basically a convoy, because they're hauling all this gold and fancy clothes and silver with him. He had it in his mind he was going to roll up there. This man was going to come out, call on the name of the Lord and strike, you know, perhaps hit him on the head with a staff and clean him and cleanse him of his leprosy. You know, and there would be this grand, maybe some thunder, maybe some clouds would come rolling around. This is done for a reason. All of this is being done. All these things are transpiring for a reason. He had it in his head. God is going to do it, and he's going to do it this way. Now, he understands he's being sent around here, you know, something he understands that this is, he's being led here for a reason. But where he, in other words, if he thought Elisha was just some kind of phony fake and he was on a wild goose chase, then he would have been skeptical going into it at all. He wouldn't have been expecting anything at all. But obviously, he really did believe that he would be cured of the man of God. So he understood on a certain level that things, events were moving from an outside force, for lack of a better term. Where he gets hung up, though, is he's already set it in his mind how that's going to happen. He's going to roll up. The man of God is going to come out. He probably pictured the man of God as like he would be this very, I don't know, saintly looking figure. And of course, obviously, that's not what Elisha would have looked like. He was living in poverty and just scruffy. But he thought it was going to be this grand event, exactly how God was going to. And it didn't happen like that. He didn't even come out to see him, which is kind of, obviously, I think he would have thought that was disrespectful. He sends somebody out to tell him, go wash in the river 7 times. You'll be all right. And he's mad because he thinks he's just being blown off. Now, he had these expectations built up. He believed that the Lord was going to heal him and his man of God was going to do this. And then he just sends somebody out and says, go wash in the river 7 times and you'll be all right. And he's mad. Because he thinks now he does think he was led around on a wild goose chase. He thinks that this was a waste of time and he doesn't understand. He had it laid out in his mind how this was going to take place. And instead of that, he just gets told by a messenger, by an in-between person. He says to go wash in the river 7 times and you'll be all right. He's like, why do I need to wash in the river? We've got better rivers than this back in Syria. This was a waste of time. So he goes off in a rage. He just leaves. He's like, that's it. I'm going back home. He's mad and he's going back home. And his servants, we pick up at verse 13, and his servants came near and spake unto him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean. So his servants come, they get him calmed down a little bit. And they say, look, you've come all the way here. If the prophet had told you to go do some great thing, if he said, go climb this mountain, fast on the mountain 7 days, then, go find this tree and split it in two with your sword. And inside you'll find a cup of honey. Drink the cup of honey and thou shalt be clean. In other words, they say, if he had told you to do some great thing, you would have done it. If he would have given you instructions like that, you would have jumped on it and said, you'll do it. And they're like, yeah, so why won't you go do this? You're here. Go do this little thing. What's it going to hurt? What do you got to lose? If he would have told you to go do some big, difficult thing, you would have accepted that. Now you're fixing to go home in a rage and not do it. What do you got to lose? Just go wash in the river 7 times. If nothing happens, then go ahead. Yeah, you can be mad. So they convince him to do it, and he does go on and do it. So he goes down. He dips himself in the river 7 times, and guess what? He's cleaned. He's cleansed. He says his flesh went from being nasty, rotting, open sores, however you want to imagine what this leprosy would look like. It says it looked like the flesh of a child, like the flesh of a baby. It was just soft, perfect, clean flesh. Now, before we keep going, this is important when you think of what matters is, we talk a lot, I talk a lot, we discuss here on this show that faith is not an emotion. We get so hung up on emotionalism. And so often, I think, one of the things you see Christian people fail to understand, and because a lot of it is because the MCC preaches so much emotionalism because it's very effeminate in the way they do things. People put emotion, they attach an emotional feel to everything. And the Bible is all about action. Naaman, his initial reaction was to get mad and blow this off and say, this is a bunch of BS. But what did he eventually do? He went and did as he was instructed to by the Lord via the man of God. He did what he was told. And this ultimately is counted as faith. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he got mad. When one of the parables that Jesus told, you know, he says a father tells his two sons to go do such and such thing. And the first son's reaction is, says, I ain't going to do that. No, you can't tell me to do that. I'm not going to do it. I refuse to do it. But after a little bit and he cooled down a little bit, the son ultimately went on and did as he was told. When instructed, the second son says, yes, father, I'll go do it right away. But he never bothers to go around and do it. And Jesus asks, which one of the two sons actually does the work of the father? Well, obviously, it is the first son. Jesus was telling us, it doesn't matter what your emotions are. What matters is your deeds. That is your faith. It's your deeds. Now, I'm in here. His first reaction was, this is BS. He's mad. He storms off. But that doesn't matter. In the end, his faith was demonstrated by he went on down and did as he was instructed. That's all that matters. I really am coming to believe more and more that God really doesn't care pretty much at all about your emotions, aside from the fact of what you actually do. If your emotions keep you now, when his servant said, you know, why, you know, convince him to go down, if he still refused and was obstinate, then obviously he wouldn't have carried out the instructions and he wouldn't have acted in any sort of faith. But at some point he did act in faith. And what matters to the Lord is what you do, how you go on and do what you're supposed to do regardless. He went and did this, and I'm sure the whole time he was dipping himself in there, he was probably like, this isn't going to do anything. I don't even know why. This isn't going to do anything. This is stupid dipping myself in the river. Like, this is where's the thundering lightning, the clouds? But it doesn't matter because he actually did it. He was instructed by the Lord to do these things, and he went and he did it, and he was healed. Regardless of what his emotions were, I think we get too hung up on what we feel. You know, oh, if I do this, you know, you get this feeling like your emotions are somehow going to influence God. If you feel a certain way, God's not going to do this. Or if you feel another way, then that means God's going to do this, that, or the other. And it has nothing to do with it. God doesn't care about your emotions. All that matters is your faith. And your faith is demonstrated by your deeds. He went and he dipped in the river. In the parable told by Jesus, the first son who complained and his initial reaction was, I ain't doing that, actually went on and did it. He was the faithful son. The son that sat there and smiled and said, sure, daddy, whatever you say, but then went on and did his own thing. He was the unfaithful son. What matters, what God cared, what we're being told in both accounts is God cares. Your faith is demonstrated by what you do. He really doesn't care about your emotions. So our role is to make sure that we have enough control over our emotions where they don't stop us from following the instruction, from doing what we've got to do. He was mad. He left. But he got enough control over his emotions that when his servants said, look, what do you got to lose? You're here anyway. If he had told you to do some difficult thing, you'd have jumped all over that. Why not go do the simple thing? What do you have to lose? He had to have enough control over himself and control over his emotions to think about that and use some reason and say, yeah, you know, they're right. I, you know, set his pride aside and say, you know what? They're right. What do I got to lose? So he went on and he did it. And in so he demonstrated faith. So he packs up and he goes back. He goes back to Elisha, and he returned, we'll pick up at verse 15, and he returned to the man of God and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now, therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant. So he brought all this silver and gold, and he changed it. He says, look, now I know. Now you've shown me. Now I know there's only one God, and that is the Lord. Here, let me pay you. You know, let me give you. I brought all this gold and silver. You've given me, you know, you have shown me something. I have received not just a cleansing of his flesh to be made whole, but now he understands there is but one God. He, you know, here, let me give you something. Let me give you a reward for this. But he said, this is Elisha. But he said, as the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, But he refused. So Elisha says, no, I'm not going to take anything. It's kind of like when you see, it's like this joke. I saw a black comedian one time. He was joking about how different people pay their tabs. And, you know, he was saying, like, when black people go out and eat, you know, this was back, you know, obviously this was years ago when comedy was, you know, a lot more people could poke fun at each other and themselves without the eternally offended making something of it. Anyway, this black comedian said, when black people go out to eat, when they bring the check, they're all looking at going through it like itemizing. It's like, okay, now, you know, I had the chicken wings, but I only had a glass of water. And he says, when white people go out and eat and they bring the check, they have this argument over who's going to pay. Oh, no, I got that. No, I'm paying. And I imagine it kind of being like that. Now, Ammon's like, here, let me give you something. And Elisha's like, no, I'm not going to take anything. Well, come on now. I really want to give you something. No. Like, yeah, just picture. It doesn't really say that, but I do. I kind of picture like one of those white people interactions. Let me give you something. No, it's okay. No, let me, you know. Now, reeling things back into a serious note. Understand, Elisha lived in poverty. I mean, he had his needs met. He had a little shelter over his head, but he was basically living in poverty. So why would he not take this money? Why would he not take a little something for himself? He could better himself. He could have a nice change of clothes and some fancy clothes for a change and enough silver and a little gold here. He could buy him some stuff, you know, maybe a better mount so he could, you know, travel around or whatever. So why? What was Elisha? And this is one of those spots where we have to kind of put ourselves in their shoes and try to figure out, why did he refuse? Because obviously there was a reason. It would have benefited him. And I think Elisha's reasoning was quite simple. Elisha felt like he didn't do anything. You know, basically, he just sent a messenger and said, well, this is what God says to do. Elisha himself didn't come out and do what Naaman pictured and imagined him doing, you know, holding up his staff and thunder and lightning, and all of a sudden he's clean. I think Elisha's reasoning was simply that he didn't do anything. I mean, really, what are you paying me for? All I did was have somebody come out and say, well, God says go out and dip yourself in the river 7 times, you'll be all right. Well, what's that worth? And as far as, you know, I relayed the message, but that was my obedience to God. So this gift came to you. This was from God. And Elisha was like, well, what are you paying me for? I didn't cleanse you. Elisha didn't any more cleanse Naaman of his leprosy than the king of Israel. Remember, the king of Israel was all upset. Is like, oh, he's picking a fight with me. How am I supposed to clean this? It's not possible for me to cleanse a man of leprosy. He's just picking a fight with me. Likewise, Elisha was like, I didn't cleanse this guy. I didn't do anything. All I did was pass the word on. God said, yeah, you know, go dip in the river and you'll be made clean. So Elisha's reasoning, I believe, was simply, what am I being paid for? All I did was pass the message along. I mean, what value is that? Now, you contrast Elisha's reaction. In the book of Acts, in the New Testament, there was a sorcerer who saw the apostles laying on of hands and healing, and people were able to speak tongues and stuff, which means other languages. And he went to him and said, give me this power so I can do this too. And he brought them some money. Give this power to me. And they cursed him. And he said he was cursed for thinking that the gift of God, the gift of the Holy Spirit, could be bought with money. That'll be more relevant as we conclude our story here in a moment. But the way Elisha reacted, and again, if we use some reason here, I think it's reasonable to assume that he just figured it really kind of didn't even cross his mind because he didn't do anything. What am I being rewarded for? Most people, for being honest, we would have took some of that money. We take this blessing. You see the TV evangelists with their big ornate mega churches. You think any of them would have turned down the money? Thank you. You know, they wouldn't. They would take that money. A lot of people would be tempted to take the money. But again, Elisha simply reasoned that he didn't do anything. Well, what are you paying me for? And we contrast that with the sorcerer in the Book of Acts that wanted to pay money to get this sort of thing, in a lot of ways, I think Elijah would have reasoned he would be basically himself attempting to profit from the Lord's labor. It would be something of the Lord's. If the guy would have said, well, we're going to build an altar here and we're going to burn a sacrifice for the Lord, I'm sure he wouldn't have stopped him. He'd say, yeah, you'll offer a sacrifice to the Lord and thanks for this. But Elijah was like, I didn't do anything. I didn't even come out and see you. And obviously there was a reason for that. All of these things are happening. There is a reason. Elisha didn't even come out and look at him. He just sent somebody and said, go wash in the river. So all of the glory is God's. This 100% was done by God, not by Elisha. Now, since Elisha has refused to take any money, Naaman says, well, let me say this one thing then. I know, and again, we're kind of skipping through here, but he says, basically, look, I know now there is only one God, the Lord God. I know this. And he says, let me be pardoned because, you know, in my situation, with my position that I hold, when I'm going to have to go in to this temple of this other God with my master, the king, I got to go in and I'm required to put my hand on his shoulder and we bow together before this altar. Let me be pardoned of this because look, I know there's only one God. Let this not be held against me. I just have to do this as a part of my position. And basically Elisha says, yeah, don't worry about it. Go on in peace. You know, go on your way. You know, the Lord isn't going to put you in a situation. There'd be nothing for the Lord to profit of that. What God was doing was being done right here. Yeah, go on. The Lord isn't worried about that. So Naaman goes ahead and he takes his company, all the silver and gold and all the fancy clothes he brought, and he starts heading back home. And our story should end there. But alas, it does not. We'll pick up at verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master hath spared Naaman, this Syrian, in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. So Elisha's servant, Gehazi, he sees all this going on and he can't believe. Because if he's Elisha's servant and Elisha's basically living in poverty, his servant's living in poverty. And he's standing there, he's like, I can't believe he's not taking anybody. First off, there's so much here. I gotta slow down. I'm getting carried away. I gotta slow down. Let's back up. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master hath spared Naaman, this Syrian. So he has it in his mind, Elisha healed him. He doesn't understand why Elisha. We just went through, you know, what would have been Elisha's reasoning for not taking the money, which is just simply he didn't do anything. But his servant is sitting there going, he healed this guy and he's not taking any of the silver, gold. We're living in poverty here. What, he healed this Syrian of all people. And then he doesn't take anything. See, he doesn't understand. Elijah understood. He didn't do anything. He just sent some middleman out. He didn't even want there to be any way to misconstrue that he had done something. But his servant has missed that point. He's going, Elisha healed this guy when Elisha didn't heal anybody. He just passed the word on. God said to do this, so, you know, go on and do it. He's missing. And he didn't take any money. I'm going to go, and I'm going to get something back off of this old boy. I'm going to go chase this guy down and get some of this money. This is ridiculous. He healed this guy. We taking some money. Now, did he really not understand that Elisha did not heal this guy, but the Lord himself had healed this guy? Thus, you're taking something that would be owed to God. If any reward if any kind of payment is due, it's due to God, not Elisha. Elisha just passed the message along. I think this also bears a warning that a lot of times we interpret things the way we want to interpret them for our own benefit. He interprets this as Elisha healed this guy in order to provide himself justification to go get the money. But at the end of the day, he wanted to go get some of that money. He would have read the situation however he needed to read it to justify to himself going after this guy and getting some of that money. Our justifications are what will trip us up every time. Our justifications we make for the things we do. And in the New Testament, we're told over and over to confess our sins. And people always read that like we're supposed to go down here to your local church, stand up in front of everybody in your community and tell them all your deep, dark, ugly secrets. But that's not, I do not believe that that's what it means. It means you need to get rid of your justifications. If you confess your sins, you sit here and you look, because you've got sin you're dealing with in your life. And if you look at those things, your first reaction is going to be say, yeah, well, I only do that because, well, I do that because of this. Well, I do that because I have a reason. You see, I have a justification for that. For you to repent from your sins, which is to take the action of turning away from them, which can be a long process depending on what kind of sin and how well embedded it is in your life, deeply embedded in your life it is. It is a process, and you're never going to make that process unless you start getting rid of all your excuses, all of your reasons for this. For the reasons why you do, you got to strip away those justifications, because when you leave this world and go to the kingdom of God, they won't be there. You won't have those justifications. You're going to be standing there basically like naked. Everybody knows. If you get rid of those beforehand, it's not a problem because you've already dealt with that. That's why it's important. It's why it's so important to strip that away. Because when you go to the eternal realm, when you leave this temporal realm, you're not going to have those. They're going to be literally stripped off of you. If you've already dealt with that, that's not a big deal because nothing has changed. You've already faced that. You've already gotten rid of all of those justifications. Getting a little off topic, but the point here is the servant is justifying what he wants to do, which is go get paid. So he does. He goes chases, and Naaman sees him coming, and his first reaction is something wrong? And he asks him, is all well? You know, is everything all right? What's going on? He said, no. Everything's fine. It's just that we've got some other guys. We've got some guys coming down, sons of the prophets, and my master, he just forgot. You see, he forgot, and we need some of that silver and some of those two changes. Don't want to be too greedy. Just, we need two changes of fancy clothes to give these guys and some silver to pass on to them. And my master forgot and sent me after you to come get this. And I was like, well, no problem. I mean, I brought all of this to pay somebody. If the man of God just forgot or whatever, he didn't think much of it. And he says, sure, here it is. You know, he didn't hesitate or question. He just says, here it is. And he gave, in fact, he sent it with two servants who the guy wouldn't even have to carry it. He sent the servants, carried it right back to him, delivered it to him. And then the servant of Elisha, you know, took it in, squirreled it away and hid it away. We pick up at verse 25. But he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, thy servant went no whither. Where you been? So it reminded me when I read this, it reminded me of all the way back in the book of Genesis, when God's walking through the garden. He says, Adam, where you at? It's like he doesn't know. Where are you at? Oh, I'm over here. What's going on with you? Well, I just said, where you been? I didn't go anywhere. He went far enough to go catch this guy. And it was far enough back that he sent two servants to carry this stuff so the guy could make it. But his first reaction is, I don't know nothing about that. I didn't go anywhere. I just go ahead and finish it out. So after saying, I don't know nothing about that. And he said unto him, went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? So he saw it. He saw it in the, however, I don't know. But he saw it. My heart went with thee when the man turned around in the chariot and saw it. I saw all of this transpire. Now, understand, we don't trick, we don't fool God. Now, this is the man, if the man of God at that time was able to do that, God already knows. You're going to trick him, you're going to see him. This is the other reason we got to get rid of our justification. God already knows. And is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? Is this the time for that? In other words, Elisha's like, what are you doing? I mean, really, man, what are you doing? Is this the time for that? You will not understand what is going on here, and you think this is the time to put some money in your pocket? And we'll finish with the last verse. The leprosy, therefore, that Naaman shall... The leprosy, therefore, of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. So in receiving the silver and a couple changes of clothes, what did it cost the servant? By taking this little trivial thing, what did it cost him? Remember, Naaman, he came with all of this stuff. He was ready to pay everything he had. He would have probably gone ahead and gave away his chariots and horses, and him and his servants would have walked back to Syria if that's what it cost to get him cleansed of the leprosy. This guy goes, takes some silver and two changes of fancy clothes and thinks he's come out on the deal. But he didn't consider the price he'd have to pay. The price was the leprosy now was on him, not just him, but onto his descendants forever. Just as a last bit of reflection, we got to get out of here and run long. But just as a last thing to reflect on, at the time when he got that silver, he got some money and a couple changes of fancy clothes, and he was feeling good about that. If you think about this in the context of how short and temporary this life is, and we talk about this, we've talked about this before, but we're instructed, don't be envious of the rich man. When you see the rich man, don't be envious of them. It says in the New Testament, you know, if you're rich, you know, be sorrowful in that you're in your poverty. He felt like he was the servant felt like he was a little bit richer. He came out on this deal. When people profit by wickedness, when people profit by sin, you were trading. If you look at somebody who's extreme, if you were to look at somebody who's extremely wealthy that is godless, when you understand how short of a time our lifetimes are, it's as foolish as the servant of Elisha going out and taking some silver and two changes of clothes in exchange for now he suffers from his skin white and like dead and rotting off. And not just him, but his descendants from here on are going to look the same way. They're going to suffer from the same disease. Was that worth it? I don't care how rich somebody is in this life. Trust me, it ain't worth it. I don't care how wealthy they are, respected, how much power they wield. It doesn't matter. This time is so absurdly and ridiculously short compared to the eternal realm, compared to the realm of the Lord where time does not exist, as to be stupid to sit here and trade for something that just is not even the blink of an eye. When people take the ticket and essentially sell their souls to Satan in exchange for a little wealth and a little fame and a little celebrity status or whatever the hell, it is just like the servant Elisha going out and taking some silver and a couple changes of fancy clothes, and all he bought for himself was a curse. We're going to wind up running really long here, so we got to wrap up on that note. We're not going to do it this way every week, but there was so much, and I think y'all get that. There was so much in this chapter, and I really wanted, I thought, well, I could talk about this or I could talk about that, but I really wanted to just cover the whole context of what transpired, because there's just so many different interactions here that I think we can apply to ourselves and learn, you know, for ourselves and for our own lives and how, you know, we relate to the Lord and things that God does in our own lives. So we just kind of did it a little different this week. We may do it that way again in the future if it works out that way. Anyway, as always, I hope I hope you got something out of it. As always, I hope you enjoyed the entirety of the show. As always, I appreciate every one of you listening, and I do hope it's a blessing for you. As always, I do appreciate y'all not forgetting Sven Longshanks and my friend and his situation and the trial that he is going through, his persecution. As always, I appreciate those of y'all who've gotten something out of it and put a little something in the plate. It's a blessing for me. I really do appreciate it. And as always, I hope you'll join us next week right here for the Parish of the Patriots.